Hello, and welcome to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show, prescribing hope for healthy families here on American Family Radio. Here's your host, Professor, Pediatric Nurse Practitioner, and Mom of Four, Dr. Jessica Peck.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome, welcome wherever you are. If you're driving down the road, if you're in the carpool line, if you are at school, at work, wherever you are, welcome. I'm so glad that you have tuned in. Thank you so much for that. I know that in a day where we are living at the speed of a smartphone, your time is your most valuable commodity. And the fact that you've turned on this radio station means you are invested in your parenting journey or in the parenting journey of people around you that you care about. And listen, this is a really hard time to be a parent. And these are really hard issues that kids today are facing. It seems like every day we are facing a new threat that we think, where in the world did that come from? And fear grips our heart. But let me tell you, my mission here is for us not to have fear-based parenting, but to adopt faith-informed parenting, to know that no matter what comes our way, if we are invested in building healthy relationships that are grounded in Christ, there is no challenge that we can't face and get through together. The fact is that this world is desperately broken, and we are in need of a savior. We cannot do all of these things on our own. And my own personal journey has been far from perfect and far from easy. Honestly, I have faced a lot of valleys and a lot of really difficult challenges in my life. And you know, I'm here talking to you not because, oh, well, I have it all together and I have all the answers, but because I found hope. And I have found healing along the way, and I want to share that with you. Now, a lot of times on this show, we have amazing guests who share their perspectives and who share the hope and the healing and the encouragement that the Lord has put on their heart. But from time to time, I just take the opportunity to have a heart-to-heart about really important things. And today is one of those days. And we're going to talk about a tough issue, but one that we can learn to face together. Now, today we're talking about substance abuse, about addiction. And I think there is no other issue that is facing families today like addiction is, because addiction is so secretive by nature. And there are so many people struggling with addiction who are very high functioning. And it doesn't look like what we think it looks like. And especially in a faith-based community, we tend to hide it more because the stigma and the shame of it are real. And sometimes it is really difficult because we may make a poor choice, or sometimes we don't make a poor choice. We just fall into addiction by ways that are really unintentional, but that lure is very, very real. And before we know it, we are hooked. And it's important for us not to have blinders on as Christians and think everybody we go to church with, there's nobody here who struggles with addiction. That is just not the truth. And we are seeing tactics that are targeting our kids more than ever before. And so when we were growing up, it was really difficult. You had to get yourself in a pretty difficult situation to be able to access drugs, because even before cell phones, you would have to know someone who knew someone and go to some place where you're exchanging, you know, something in a seedy neighborhood on a corner. But now kids can buy drugs off of social media so easily. There are even emojis that are used so that kids don't even have to use words. And this can be very difficult to pick up, very difficult to track, very difficult to monitor. And kids think that this is normalized, and they may think that they're taking medication that is for a good thing. You know, they see diet pills normalized or painkillers normalized and think, oh, this is just an easy, quick way to get a real medication. But we know that there are nefarious actors out there who want our kids to be addicted because that makes money. And That is just such a terrible thing. And so today I'm going to share with you from my book, Behind Closed Doors, a guide to help parents and teens navigate through life's toughest issues, where as a pediatric nurse practitioner, I have written about the 12 most common things that I see in pediatrics. And let me just stop here and say, I have to say it again. I know I've said it before, but I started out as a pediatric nurse almost 30 years ago, and I don't even recognize my practice anymore. When I first started out, what we would do in the springtime would be set out a tent on the corner, and I would man this tent, and people would drive by and open the door and show me little rashes on their kids. And I would say, yes, it's chicken pox, or no, it's not, because of course we didn't want them to come in the waiting room because it was so contagious. I mean, these were the kinds of things that we dealt with. And very rarely did I see kids with anxiety or depression. I mean, it did happen, but not nearly like it does today. And today, this is the majority of what I see. I rejoice when someone comes in with just a basic cold or strep throat or an ear infection. And I think, well, this is great because this is something that I can fix. But so many of these other issues are so much more complex, and we are seeing skyrocketing levels of drug addiction and drug experimentation, especially after COVID, because we had kids who were isolated, kids who were masking their pain, kids who had easy access to substances. And so I'm going to talk to you today about what to do about this, how you can help prevent drug experimentation in your kids, and what to do if your kids experience that. And so I'll be sharing. Now, in each chapter that I write in Behind Closed Doors, I start with a story from my own personal experience. And this story in particular was very difficult for me to write, if I'm being honest, because it is the most personal story that I wrote, but I'm going to share it with you so that you see some of my own personal journey. So here is my story as I wrote it. I was nervous. I was about to see my brother for the first time since he returned from rehab. Our relationship suffered for 2 decades from brokenness, hurt, neglect, and heartbreak. His struggles with substances began in high school as a teen, and they progressively spiraled out of control until arriving at a point of crisis in his marriage and with his children. I had no idea what to expect as I waited for him to arrive. But God, the moment I saw the light in his eyes, I knew God had restored my brother from addiction. He restored our relationship from brokenness. He restored his family to be whole again. God restored relationships that seemed unsalvageable. My brother exchanged darkness for light, hurt for healing, destruction for restoration, mourning for laughter, loneliness for companionship. And it's never too late to start again. Healing is messy, and it's a back and forth sort of thing. But I celebrate answered prayers 20 years in the making, even in the moment, even if those prayers are temporarily answered before struggle comes again. That happens. So that is, I'll tell you a little bit more about my story and my family, but really, truly, substance abuse is one of the most difficult things for me to talk about because I have lived through its torrential aftermath. Not personally, I have not personally struggled with addiction. And that's one of the reasons why I don't drink at all. And I have talked about that before. And just knowing now the genetic predisposition, that is just something that I have decided to completely remove from my life as a potential temptation. But before we start talking about some of the specifics, I need us to be on the same page and to see addiction for what it really is, because it is a destructive coping mechanism that people use to deal with the unbearable. Now, a lot of parenting advice tells you we're going to get into those specifics and you know, those kinds of things. But this is a broader discussion where we are seeking understanding together. First of all, we have to understand that substance abuse is so much more than getting high. That is not what it's about. Substance abuse, addiction is a symptom of a much more complex and intricate working of the brain, and especially developing teen brains. They are particularly susceptible to addiction. But when people use substances, it's a way to escape, and something that just feels like it's inescapable. And it's just a way, how do I get through today? How do I avoid emotional pain, even if that's only lasting for an hour or two? And the truth is, as a society, we have really failed. We have failed a generation of teens to adequately respond with seriousness and committing resources to the mental health crisis. And that's where we see all in the headlines, kids who are struggling with anxiety, depression, and then we just tell them they just need to suck it up. And so they can't. And they may turn to other ways of numbing that emotional pain and other ways of coping. And those feelings are not going away anytime soon. I am convinced that COVID was a serious social, emotional, psychological injury to this generation of kids. But listen, don't despair. It's not all doom and gloom, because as my friend and frequent guest Lauren Gaines says, often, what if you were put on this earth for such a time as this? God is not surprised by any of these events, and He knows exactly which child you have and for what purpose. And He knows that you're the perfect parent and the perfect time for that perfect kid who is not so perfect in an imperfect world that makes imperfect choices. But He, in His goodness, gave you to that child for a reason. And we can get through this together. We can overcome this as families. But the truth is that using a substance is really not the issue. Drug use is not the issue. It's just the tip of the iceberg. And as a society, it does feel to me like we are on the Titanic. And I see teens from all walks of life engaging in substance abuse. We have to throw out the stereotype of what we're looking for, because I see athletes, I see band kids, I see cheerleaders, I see church kids, I see valedictorians, I see all kinds of kids, because kids are kids and they lack coping skills and social support to navigate the crushing pressure of societal expectations. And substance abuse is very easily hidden in families for generations, because there is secrecy, there is silence that comes along from this. And I understand this really on a very personal level, because if you looked at me from the outside, I had an idyllic childhood. My parents were high school sweethearts. They married right out of high school. They had five kids. I was the oldest. Now you understand some of my overachiever tendencies, but we didn't have much money, but we did have a modicum of social standing in a small town America. My grandfather was a mayor. He was a school board president. He was the only person on both sides of my family to get a university degree until me, and I became the first woman to get a university degree. And the truth is that we, as children, we were very well-mannered, we were well-dressed, we were well-spoken, and we were in church literally every time the doors were open. And we climbed on top of a pedestal, if I'm being really honest, and that was unsustainable. But in that prism of perfection, addiction did not spare our family. See, addiction runs dark and deep, like a strangling vine winding through a family tree. And I discovered this as I was in a genomics class during my master's program. And it doesn't matter if you remove the offending substance, there are very characteristic patterns of behavior that come along with addiction, and you have to unlearn and relearn those patterns of behavior. And we just didn't know that. We didn't know that a generation ago, like we know that today. And that dangerous combination of bearing that unrelenting burden of perfection and propping up our pedestal and looking at our family history and our home's culture of silence on real issues, that collided with easy access to substances that gave my brother temporary relief from his pain. Now, we were in church every single Sunday and everybody knew, but we didn't say a word, because if I'm honest, we didn't know what to say or how to act. And that is really hard. And we were really worried about, I think, what would people think? Like, what would happen? The world would be over if we disclosed this. But God gives freedom. God gives freedom when you confess your sins, when you confess your struggles. God gives freedom and hope for a way out. And when we come back, I'm going to share with you some of that hope that I found. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Why is our society so ravenous to abort babies? According to a former Satanist, the demonic forces have a bloodlust for the innocents, and sickly believe their blood sacrifice empowers evil. Make no mistake, we are fighting a spiritual battle as we protect the most innocent among us, babies in their mother's womb. Preborn stands on the front lines of this battle, and their network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, often next to abortion mills where unspeakable evil takes place every day. Preborn offers God's love and life to protect hurting women and precious preborn babies. And every time a baby is saved, which happens 200 times a day, good conquers evil. Please make your most generous gift to empower good and rescue precious souls. For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound that doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com.
You're listening to the Dr. Nurse Mama Show with Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome back. We are having a heart-to-heart about a tough issue, but one that we can find hope for healing through together, and that is substance abuse and addiction. And before the break, I was sharing a little of my personal story and looking at my family tree, and I really can't tell you how just eye-opening that was. This was around, as my kids will say, this pains me to say it, y'all, but it was about the turn of the century, and that's when they were just actually mapping the human genome, and we were starting to really learn a lot about DNA and how trauma can impact our DNA, the way it's read and transcribed. And we know now about something called epigenetic changes, which are environmental influences that change our DNA. And I looked at our family tree and I thought, yeah, this is it. Because even again, if we have a generation, a branch that says we don't have any technical addiction, you know, there's no drug addiction or alcohol addiction or other addictions, you know, we still had unhealthy ways of relating. And addiction tends to respawn itself. So even if you give up something like alcohol, it's very easy to pick up something like smoking or vaping or phone scrolling or obsessive cleaning of your house or just any other number of addictive tendencies. That's why it's so important to have a team around you, to have some counseling, to have a healthcare provider, to have resources available to you for recovery, recognizing that even if you don't struggle with addiction, you may struggle with unhealthy ways of relating to each other that you don't even know are unhealthy. You might just think this is how the world works, but you can learn better and you can do better, because I know I have been there. So let's start at the beginning and let's talk about kids today. And let me give you just kind of a 101 primer on addiction and substances. And this is really just a simple first step, but again, to get us all on the same page so that we can have some perspective together. A substance, as I'm saying it, is anything that alters your mood or your thoughts. Now, this can be alcohol, it can be nicotine, prescriptions, marijuana, or illicit drugs like cocaine or heroin or fentanyl, those kinds of things. And people experiment with substances because they're trying to deal with social pressure, they're trying to make life transitions, or they're managing stress, they're dulling physical or emotional pain. And it is not the answer, but it is the norm. People do it. And as parents, we often react to the action of using those substances without stopping and considering what is the driving force that caused that symptom of substance use. Because substances activate our brain's reward system. I mean, they flood our brain with dopamine, and that regulates how we move, how we feel, how we think. So obviously using substances impacts how you move, how you feel, how you think in a negative way. And teens are more addicted because they have lower thresholds of exposure. Their brains overreact to those substances, and they also more permanently impact the pathways of pleasure that are activated in our brain. And our brain starts to prefer that pathway until it becomes a rut in our brain, and it's very difficult to overcome. Now, addiction in and of itself is not something that happens overnight. You are not overnight going to be addicted to drugs or alcohol. It is a long and gritty road that starts with something called substance misuse. Now, if we're looking at this in a clinical term and we're learning about that, then we see that's not following the instructions for prescriptions or over-the-counter medicine. Maybe it's taking an extra pill if that recommended dose isn't working, or sometimes we might see kids misuse attention deficit medication because it suppresses your appetite and they think it can make you lose weight. But there's no intent to get high. And no one says like, hey, I think I want to become an addict today. Like that just doesn't happen. But the most commonly misused substance is actually a psychostimulant. It causes neurological arousal and motor activation. So what does that mean? It gets you going. It just gives you more alertness. What am I talking about? Well, here's where I'm going to step on some toes. Yep, I'm talking about caffeine. Are you surprised? It's actually socially acceptable. And it's quite marketable to boast about our caffeine dependence. I mean, I know I'm pointing my fingers at myself, like saying, how many signs do you say to say, I love Jesus and caffeine, or give me coffee in the morning before you even speak to me? I get it. So don't worry though, I'm not messing with your morning cup of joe. I love coffee just as much as the next person. But it's kind of easy to see how kids are watching our messaging on that. And you can be addicted to caffeine. You can be literally addicted to caffeine. But let's think about that mindset. We talk about that. Coffee is, you know, very normal to talk about. I'm addicted. I'm dependent. I need it. And it's kind of funny. But really, the next step up for kids are energy drinks, and they are promoted with similar claims like coffee. Hey, boost your energy and your alertness. And energy drinks are basically the coffee for this generation of young people. And almost half of teenagers are regularly consuming them. Now, an 8-ounce cup of coffee has about 100 milligrams of caffeine, but energy drinks have up to 240 milligrams of caffeine. So we're talking 2.5 times and more. That's a lot of caffeine for a developing teen brain. And those energy drinks often come with a boatload of sugar too. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends no energy drinks for teens. And I agree with that recommendation, because what we find is escalating risk-taking. We find teens between the ages of 15 and 23 who combine alcohol with energy drinks are 4 times more likely to high-intensity binge drink than teens who don't. So what does this mean? It means teens will often combine energy drinks with alcohol because it keeps them alert enough to enjoy the sensation of being drunk without passing out. That's just speaking colloquially, just speaking kind of informally and candidly. But let's talk about the problem with teens drinking alcohol, because again, addiction is the gritty end of a long road, but the most easily accessible and socially acceptable substances are alcohol for teens. It is very easy to get it. And there's a myth where some people will say, hey, it's a rite of passage. We all drink in high school. They'll be fine. Those are just simply not true, and it would be unkind of me to tell you that they are in any way. Underage drinking is risky, and it is illegal in most cases. Now, in some states, teens can legally drink in the presence of a parent or guardian, but legal does not mean safe, and alcohol is not safe for developing teen brains. So parents may say, I'd rather them do it here than out there. I would rather them not do it at all, and talk with them about that. But fear-based tactics don't work. And, you know, ultimatum, authoritarian, you are not going to do it, it's my way or the highway, that doesn't work either. But Why do we insist as parents on wearing their seatbelt and not texting while driving or just shrug while they're drinking? That's not okay. Teens are drinking, though. This is a reality that we have to face, and you don't need me to tell you that. Here are some statistics that are scary. Nearly 1 in 5 teens will get in a car with a drunk driver, and 2,000 die in alcohol-related crashes each year. Now, in college, more than 1/3 of students binge drink, and alcohol causes all kinds of increased risk factors. It causes increased arousal, aggression. It lowers your inhibition. It increases the risk of falling, getting in a car accident, getting burned, having alcohol poisoning, experiencing violence. And long term, we look at it causes increased risk of heart disease, cancer, and sexually transmitted infections. Now, this is really sobering here, but you have to know that more than half of sexual assault cases on college campuses are linked to alcohol. And up to 15% of college freshman girls are assaulted while they're incapacitated. Now, this does not, to be very clear, alcohol consumption does not in any way justify assault in any way. But it does compound the level of distress and self-blame that victims can feel because they feel ashamed by what they did. And so these are just realistic risks that you need to know about. Now, let's talk a little bit about marijuana. So when we're talking about the difference between, remember I told you the first step is misuse, and then we have abuse. That happens with alcohol, and that definitely happens with marijuana. There is nobody who consumes marijuana without the intent to get high. And that's the difference between misuse and abuse. Abuse is you are trying to get that feeling of being high. Now, when at the time I wrote this book, it may have changed a little bit in the year or so following, but 36 states had legalized marijuana use. And let me just clarify something here, that medical marijuana is just marijuana with a prescription. There's nothing really different about it other than it is prescribed. And the truth is, there is not enough research to support the use of medical marijuana for teens, although there are some narrow recommendations for some CBD for severe seizures and some other very rare circumstances. But 18 states at the time, again, of this writing had legalized recreational use. We've got teas, we've got oils, we've got tinctures, we've got capsules, we've got dried forms of it, we have edibles. And now, even since I've written the book, we have a significant increase in something called Delta 8 THC. And this is kind of a loophole that happened in a law around hemp products. And we know that about 11% of high school seniors in the United States as of right now are reporting using Delta 8 THC. And again, legal doesn't mean safe. Marijuana is not legal under the age of 21 in any state, as far as I know, and it does negatively impact judgment and memory, and it does serve as a gateway to abuse other drugs and increases the risk for suicide. If you smoke it, it can damage your lungs, but again, unsafe does not stop teens from trying it. And it's really hard because actually one of the effects that we've seen of legalizing marijuana in a lot of states is unintended ingestion. So we see people eating it, and especially kids, because they look like cookies, they look like candy, it looks like something fun to eat. You have no idea there is marijuana in it. And we're seeing really increased numbers of kids coming to the emergency room for unintended ingestion. But marijuana does impair driving at twice the rate of alcohol. It increases the likelihood of danger taking in that. And that is something really that impacts people on a very difficult level. If you know anyone who has lost a loved one in a car crash related to alcohol and substance abuses, that is extremely painful. And so once you start abusing and you start getting that feeling of high, that's where you're starting to worry about addiction. And it's going to worsen as it worsens. Your thoughts, your attitude, your energy, your worldview are increasingly dominated by thinking about how can I get drugs and where can I get drugs and where can I use drugs. But a lot of people who secretly struggle are high functioning. So our biased perception of looking for somebody who looks like, quote unquote, a junkie is really students and parents and teachers and elected officials. It can be anyone. And a lot of times we see this and we just kind of side-eye each other. It's a known open secret, but nobody says anything. But as we progress down the road to addiction, those social effects become more prominent and relationships crumble and you experience psychological, physical, and emotional harm. You get financial stress because you're starting to spend all your money. You might have legal consequences because you're getting arrested or charged with things, and your daily interactions are characterized by deception and manipulation and fear. Basically, your life starts to fall apart. And substance abuse becomes addiction when that behavioral choice becomes a brain disease with chemical changes. That is, regardless of the consequences, when you still have compulsive drug use, you know it's harmful. You know it's harming you. You know it's harming other people around you, but you still are doing it. This is a genuine sickness that can very rarely be overcome without professional help. Once you have progressed to that point of addiction, there are cases of miraculous healing, but those are not the norm. And it almost always requires professional help, whether to manage symptoms of withdrawal, to manage mainly those underlying risks of underlying experiences of trauma and mental health conditions. All of those things have to be addressed, and that is really hard. And then when you abuse more and more often, your brain becomes tolerant of that, and you need more of that substance to feel the same effect. And then your body starts to rebel if you don't have it. And you start to feel withdrawal where you feel like you're physically dying. And the only thing that's going to make it better is having more of that, what you now view as your life-saving medication, when the reality is it's killing you very slowly. And those symptoms of withdrawal make rational thought impossible. Teens feel ill, they view that substance of choice as a cure, and they it's really a scary place to be. And intervention, the truth is, it's going to require more than faith, more than tough love, although those are essential elements that are there. And I see a lot of families who are more afraid of the impact that telling about your trouble with addiction will have, rather than the threat of death staring you right in the face. And this is difficult. So when we come back, I'm going to talk about what do you do if your teen is struggling, and where can we find hope in scripture? I'll talk to you about the story of David slaying the giant. Addiction is a giant. And the most famous giant of all in the Bible is Goliath. But David defeated him with a sling and some stones, and we'll talk about how we can apply that lesson of faith when we come back.
Podcasts of the Dr. Nurse Mama Show are available on the podcast page at AFR.net. Now, back to Dr. Jessica Peck on American Family Radio.
Well, hey, friends, and welcome back to this tough heart-to-heart we're having about addiction and how it impacts our teens. And listen, there is so much we could talk about in impacting family dynamics and dealing with, you know, the loved ones who are watching addiction and what are the boundaries there. And I just can't cover all of that in 47 minutes, but hopefully this will give you some hope and some healing along the way. Now, if you're looking for some resources, especially for parents who are struggling with addiction, you might want to check out Celebrate Recovery. That is a faith-based recovery program that is offered through a lot of churches. And the main message that I want to get across to you today is, number one, prevention. It is possible to prevent your kids from experimenting with substances. And the way you do that is by building healthy relationships with open communication and pathways for empowerment so they know what to do, who to call, when they encounter temptation or situations where they're exposed to substances. And the second key thing that I want to tell you is that if you have a teen, a child who is struggling with addiction, it is so important to have the courage to act early, because the earlier you act, the better it is for their brain and the better chance they will have of recovering early and not making this a lifelong struggle. Now, a lot of us as parents, we think this is not going to happen, but let me tell you, I have seen and I shared in Behind Closed Doors some real life examples of really great kids who made really poor impulsive choices. And if you look at the government's initiative of One Pill Can Kill, which I've talked about before, we know that one pill laced with fentanyl can kill a kid, and they may be thinking they're just trying something for the first time, or they may even be thinking they're taking a legitimate ibuprofen. And so it's important. And when we look at the statistics, we know that a lot of those kids, it's their very first time to experiment and they overdose and die. I mean, that is just the absolute truth. And so it's important. And when we look at texting and vocabulary lingo, watch for things that look concerning. So for example, triple V is Vicodin, Valium, and vodka. But we've got words like kickers, Roxy, and M30. Those are all prescription painkillers. Smarties, A-Train, Study Buddies, those are ADHD medications. Chicken feed, yellow cake can mean methamphetamines, and inhalants are sometimes called whippets or huffing highballs. Now, for a lot of you, you're going to think, I've never heard any of those words, but here's the point. The point is not to know all of these words or to be an expert on all of these vocabulary or emojis. The point is, when you hear your teens using language you don't understand, to ask in plain language, what does this mean? Tell me what this means. And ask about unfamiliar words. Don't adopt the my kid would never mentality, because that creates such a steep barrier for disclosure. They think, oh, my parents think I would never do this. I could never tell them. If you see physical signs of drug use, if you see them stumbling or slurring their words or bloodshot eyes, just ask them straight up, openly and plainly, are you drinking or using drugs? Just ask and say, I'm concerned about you, and I see these can be signs, and so I love you enough to ask you plainly. And if they say yes, or if you're not satisfied, then take them to a healthcare provider. Get them tested. Be courageous enough to let them be mad at you and say, something is going on and I want to figure out what that is. Now, it could be other things. It could be a physical, legitimate health problem. It could be something like mono. You don't know. But either way, you need some help in figuring that out. Now, if you figure out that your teen is using drugs, stay very calm. And if there are signs of active use and withdrawal, if they are having physical signs, that is a crisis situation that needs medical intervention. So you can go to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. That's the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. We call it SAMHSA. They have a treatment finder to help you, or that find someone to go to. Or if you're in doubt, just go to the emergency room. Really, truly, don't overthink it. If you're concerned, if there's signs of active use, go and find out how extensive this is. What is the scope of the problem? Now, if there's no immediate health threat, take some time to prepare. Gather facts, search their room. Yes, I think you should do that. Recruit support from people in your teen's life. Expect they're going to be angry and they're going to deny it. So somebody like a healthcare provider, an interventionist, somebody who's experienced can mediate that conversation and help you have that conversation. And if you shouldn't have this conversation while they're under the influence, just wait until they're sober, but don't wait too long. Because again, that early intervention is so important. And if they have already become chemically dependent on substances, it is not realistic or safe to expect them to just stop using cold turkey. You cannot do that. You have to go to a healthcare professional and make sure that it is safe, because some withdrawals can be life threatening. And it is a process. It's not a switch. Direct your anger at the disease rather than at your child. And that is really hard. We have to avoid shaming statements like, how could you do this? What were you thinking? All of those things just don't help. We can just say, I see that we have a problem. I'm committed to do whatever I can to help you address this and to recover from this. Because sometimes interventions, honestly, they're glamorized and they're not often successful. You have to work with a reputable treatment center to create individual treatment plans and be supportive when they make that decision to stop using it into recovery. And then you're going to need a support system. You've got to think about things like making your home safe, locking up all the substances, removing over-the-counter prescription medications and household chemicals, and setting specific expectations with clear consequences. And you're just going to need some help to develop your own healthy coping mechanisms like prayer and meditation. And you're going to need spiritual support and counseling. Now, when your teen in recovery relapses, I said when, not if, most of the time it's going to be a when, and it shouldn't be seen as a failure, but a learning opportunity. Relapse is common, and it should be treated like other physical disorders, like relapsing and diabetes. And that's difficult. But according to the best research from SAMHSA that I mentioned before, there are four factors that support recovery. First is empowering your kids to make wise choices. 2, having a safe and supportive home. 3, participating in daily meaningful activities that give purpose. And 4, nurturing a sense of community through relationships and social networks that provide support, encouragement, love, and hope. Now, these are things you cannot do alone, and I can't even possibly begin to go over here, but you need to know that you need help. And remember that scare tactics don't work for prevention. So just talk. There's some simple things that you can do in your house. You can make sure that you never share medication between your kids or between your family, because that normalizes, yeah, it's okay to take a pill that somebody else gives you. In this day and age, we just can't take that risk. So only take medication that is yours and that is prescribed for them, and get rid of medication that's left over in your home. There are pharmacies that have a take back day, and you can take that medication back to the pharmacy. That's really important. And have open discussions. Now, in Behind Closed Doors, I give you some specific ideas for how and when and where to talk to your kids and what to say. And I encourage you to explore those. But as we close here together, let me share with you and talk to you as parents, because we know statistics tell us that about 25%, about a quarter of kids, live in a home with someone who abuses substances. So that means some of you listening, you struggle yourself, or you live with someone who's struggling, and it takes an emotional and physical toll. And if you're struggling, you cannot stop on your own. You cannot manage this on your own. You need help. You need help if you're struggling with addiction to repair the ways that your brain has been conditioned to respond. But there is hope. And we know that addiction is a giant. And as I said before the break, the most famous giant of all is found in the Bible, Goliath, the Philistine champion. He challenged the Israelite army to choose someone to fight him, taunting the Israelites every morning and evening for 40 days. So let's stop and think about the biblical significance of the number 40. It is mentioned 146 times in Scripture, and 40 represents a time of trial and preparation for great change. God flooded the earth for 40 days. The Israelites wandered in the wilderness for 40 years. Saul, David, and Solomon each reigned for 40 years. Jesus fasted for 40 days and nights. There were 40 days between Jesus' resurrection and ascension, and Goliath had taunted Israel for 40 days with humiliation and fear. God sent David to the battlefield. He was a young shepherd. He was not even old enough to fight. He was mocked by the enemy. He was doubted by his people and questioned by his own brother. But in the face of this giant and armed with only 5 smooth stones and a slingshot, what did David say? He said, as we know it, in 1 Samuel chapter 17, verses 45 and 46, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hands." Now, friends, the battle seeking victory over addiction is a giant. It seems impossible, but God loves nothing more than to work in the impossible. Now, you may be in that period of trial. It might be 40 days, it might be 40 months, or even 40 years or more. We have to be realistic. I know that there is not a quick fix for anything. And some of these issues, some of these struggles with addiction, some of these broken relationships will not be fixed this side of heaven. But I encourage you to prepare your heart for what the Lord can do. When the giant of addiction taunts you with sword, with spear, with javelin, respond in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, and declare the day of your victory when the Lord will provide deliverance for you. Now, maybe that's deliverance from addiction, or maybe it's deliverance from that generational trauma. Maybe it's deliverance by putting boundaries in place where you can have time to heal. I know I experienced that, and I prayed for deliverance from addiction for my family, and God has not answered that prayer in every way, in every circumstance. But I know that God is a sun and a shield. He gives grace and glory, and no good thing does he withhold from those who walk uprightly. And I know that by removing me from some of those situations, he gave me clarity. He gave me a light in the darkness and what seemed like a lot of darkness. And he gave me grace in the moment, and he gave me glory. The Lord will give grace and glory. And the Greek word for glory is doxa, which we get doxology from. And it literally means the physical weight of God's presence. So he gave us a comfort blanket in the middle of this time of trial. And I know that God can be the glory and the lifter of your head in spite of your circumstance. And we can give thanks to God who gives us victory through Jesus. And that victory is not always what we think that it will look like. But we know that it is perfect in God's way and in God's timing. So I encourage you, at the end of every chapter, I encourage families to write, parents to write a legacy letter. So I encourage you to write a letter to your child. What is the greatest victory that you have seen in their life? Tell their story of victory. Victory in the defeat, victory in the significant, victory in the mundane. Write the story in a way they can read in the years to come as a historical account of a direct eyewitness and how their victory could change the course of history. And I'm going to close with a prayer that I wrote from 1 John 4 and 5. God, we have absolute confidence in approaching your throne. We know if we ask anything in accordance with your will, you hear us. Help us to be overcomers through you, who are greater than anything in the world. You loved us enough to send your Son. Help us abide in you, obeying your command to love by carrying the burdens of others. We see others who are struggling with addiction, and we ask, God, that you lead them to life in a mighty and miraculous way. Everyone born of God overcomes the world, the victory upon which we can rest our hearts and our faith. And even when evil seems to win or triumph, we know, God, that you are ultimately in control and we can rest in you. Well, friends, I hope that you have found yourself educated and edified. I hope that you feel engaged, equipped, encouraged, and empowered to talk to your kids about substances and about addiction, and that you will find hope and healing along the way. May the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face shine upon you and give you peace. I'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.